Clouds drift above a painting of a snow-capped mountain. White stars encircle its peak, surrounding a title which reads, A Paramount Picture. Now, in the pale light of dawn, a yellow taxi drives down a deserted Fifth Avenue. It slows alongside a curb and stops. A woman steps out, shutting the door behind her. The cab pulls away. Her back to us, she gazes up at the building facing her. A bronze statuette, holding up a clock, perches above a brass sign which reads, Tiffany and Company. In her 20s, the slim, lithe woman wears a sleeveless, floor-length black sheath dress, long black gloves, and several strands of pearls studded with glittering jewels. Clutching a sheer white wrap, she glides across the sidewalk to one of the store windows and eyes a display of diamond bracelets. She opens a paper bag, takes out a Danish, sticks it in her mouth, and pulls out a cup of coffee. Titles appear: Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Nibbling her pastry, she lifts the coffee lid, takes a sip, and turns to another window display. Inside, spotlights shine on crystal chandeliers hanging in front of a draped blue velvet cloth. Through the store window, we see her face for the first time. Delicate boned, she has a pert nose and rosy complexion. Dark sunglasses shade her almond-shaped eyes. Her brunette hair, highlighted with blonde streaks, sweeps into a French roll crowned with a small tiara. More titles appear. A Jureau Shepherd production, co-starring Patricia Neal, Buddy Ebsen, Martin Balsam, and Via Yonga, with John MacGyver, Alan Reed, Dorothy Whitney, Miss Beverly Hills, Stanley Adams, Claude Stroud, Elvia Allman, Cat, trained by Frank Inn, and also starring Mickey Rooney as Mr. Yunioshi. Based on the novel by Truman Capote, director of photography, Franz F. Planer, ASC, music by Henry Mancini, screenplay by George Axelrod, produced by Martin Jureau and Richard Shepherd, directed by Blake Edwards. She tosses the remains of her breakfast in a nearby trash can and ambles on. Later, she strolls down a tree-lined sidewalk. Lifting the hem of her dress, she dashes across the street to a brownstone. A gray-haired man, wearing a tuxedo with a red carnation pinned to the lapel, snoozes in a sedan parked at the curb. As she passes, he jolts out of his slumber.
Hey!
He follows her inside. In the vestibule, she nervously rifles through her small black evening bag.
Hey, baby, what's going on here?
Oh, hi.
She reaches for the buzzer. In an upstairs apartment, a Japanese man sits up from a futon on the floor, banging his head on a lamp. He stands up, stubs his toe, and grabs a cable on a camera, triggering a flash. Dropping it in dismay, he reaches for a pair of glasses and puts them on.
Mr. Goraitri!
He crashes into a reflecting lamp, sets it right, and presses a button to unlock the door. Downstairs, the couple enters the foyer.
What happened to you anyway? You take off for the powder room and that's the last I see you.
Now really, Harry?
Harry was the other guy. I'm Sid, Sid Arbuck. You like me, remember?
Mr. Goraitri! I protest!
Oh, darling, I am sorry, but I lost my key.
But that was 2 weeks ago. You cannot go on or keep ringing my bell. You disturb me. You must have a key made.
But it won't do any good. I just lose them all.
Come on, baby. You like me. You know you do.
I worship you, Mr. Arbuck, but good night, Mr. Arbuck.
Well, baby, wait a minute. What is this? You like me. I'm a liked guy. You like me, baby. You know you do. Didn't I pick up the check for 5 people? Your friends? I never seen them before. And when you ask for a little change for the powder room, what do I give you? A $50 bill. Now, doesn't that give me some rights?
In 30 seconds, I got to call the police. All the time a disturbance. I can't no sleep.
As Arbuck tiptoes down the stairs, Miss Golightly peeks out of her apartment.
I got to call my squad on you.
Don't be angry, you dear little man. I won't do it again. If you promise not to be angry, I might let you take those pictures we mentioned.
When?
Sometime.
Anytime.
Good night.
She blows him a kiss, then steps back inside her apartment. Outside, a cab pulls up to the brownstone. A handsome blonde-haired man with chiseled features and bright blue eyes steps out. With a trench coat draped over one arm, he wears a stylish tweed blazer and thin tie. He glances around, then shuts the car door. Moments later, in Miss Golightly's apartment, a yellow tabby cat sleeps on the black sheath cast on the floor, then leaps to a nearby bed, hopping onto the sleeping Miss Golightly. Nude under the sheets, she wears a pale blue sleeping mask trimmed with gold and two tasseled earplugs. As the cat pats her shoulder, she lifts one side of the mask. In the vestibule below, the blonde man presses one of the buzzers along a row of mailboxes. Upstairs, Miss Golightly reaches for a man's tuxedo shirt and pulls it on. Staggering against the wall for support, she buttons the back of the shirt and shuffles through her nearly barren apartment to the door. She presses the release button beside it, then opens up the door. With heavy blinking lids, she eyes the blonde-haired man who walks up the staircase carrying a suitcase. He smiles sheepishly.
I'm sorry to bother you, but I couldn't get the downstairs door open. I guess they sent me the upstairs key. I couldn't get the downstairs door open.
She cocks her ear. She takes out an earplug.
Upstairs key. I couldn't get the downstairs door open. I'm sorry to wake you.
It's quite all right. Could happen to anyone. Quite frequently does. Good night.
I hate to bother you, but if I could ask one more favor, could I use the phone?
Sure. Why not?
Thank you. Well, this is a nice little place you've got here. You just moved in too, huh?
Well, I've been here about a year. The phone's over there. Well, it was. Oh, I remember. I stuck it in the suitcase, kind of muffles the sound.
She opens a white suitcase and pulls out the phone. As he steps forward, the cat leaps onto his shoulder.
I'm sorry. Is he all right?
Sure, he's okay, aren't you, cat? Poor old cat. Poor slob without a name. The way I look at it, I don't have the right to give him one. We don't belong to each other. We just took up by the river one day. I don't even want to own anything until I can find a place where me and things go together. Not sure where that is, but I know what it's like. It's like Tiffany's.
Tiffany's? You mean the jewelry store?
That's right. I'm crazy about Tiffany's. Listen. You know those days when you get the mean reds?
The mean reds? You mean like the blues?
She clicks on a record player.
The blues are because you're getting fat or maybe it's been raining too long. You're just sad, that's all. The mean reds are horrible. Suddenly you're afraid and you don't know what you're afraid of. Did you ever get that feeling?
Sure.
Well, when I get it, the only thing that does any good is to jump into a cab and go to Tiffany's. Calms me down right away. The quietness and the proud look of it, nothing very bad could happen to you there. If I could find a real life place that made me feel like Tiffany's, then I'd buy some furniture and give the cat a name. Sorry, you wanted something. Oh, the telephone.
It's just that I was supposed to meet somebody. I mean, this is 10 o'clock Thursday morning, isn't it? I just got off a plane from Rome, and I'm not too sure.
Thursday? Is this Thursday?
I think so.
Thursday? Oh, no, it can't be. It's too gruesome.
She runs into the bathroom.
Well, what's so gruesome about Thursday?
Nothing, except I can never remember when it's coming up. Wednesdays, I generally just don't go to bed at all because I have to be up to catch the 10:45. And they're so particular about visiting hours. Would you be a darling and look under the bed and see if you can find a pair of alligator shoes?
Sure.
She feverishly brushes her teeth.
I've got to do something about the way I look. I mean, a girl just can't go to Sing Sing with a green face.
Sing Sing?
Yes, I always thought it was a ridiculous name for a prison. Sing Sing, I mean. Sounds more like it should be an opera house or something. Black alligator. You know, all the visitors make an effort to look their best. It's only fair. Actually, it's very touching, all the women wearing their prettiest things. I just love them for it. And I love the kids, too. I mean, the kids the wives bring. It should be sad seeing kids there, but it isn't. They all have ribbons in their hair and lots of shine on their shoes. You think there's going to be ice cream?
Now, as I understand it, what we're doing is getting you ready to visit somebody at Sing Sing.
That's right. You can always tell what kind of a person a man really thinks you are by the earrings he gives you. I must say, the mind reels.
May I ask whom?
Whom what? Oh, whom I go to visit, you mean?
I guess that's what I mean.
I don't know that I should even discuss it. Oh, well, they never told me not to tell anyone. But you must cross your heart and kiss your elbow.
I'll try.
You probably read about him. His name's Sally Tomato.
Sally Tomato?
Oh, don't look so shocked. They could never prove for a second that he was even part of the Mafia, much less head of it, my dear. The only thing they did prove was that he cheated at his income tax a little. Anyway, all I know is that he's a darling old man. Oh, he was never my lover or anything like that. In fact, I never knew him until after he was in prison. But I adore him now. I mean, I've been going to see him every Thursday for 7 months. Now I think I'd go even if he didn't pay me. Shoes!
You can only find one.
Rising from her makeup table, she peers under the bed.
He pays you?
That's right. Or anyway, his lawyer does. If he is a lawyer, which I doubt since he doesn't seem to have an office, only an answering service. And he always wants to meet you at Hamburger Heaven.
She grabs a shoe out of a wax fruit basket.
There you are, you sneak. Thank you.
Well.
Dress. Dress. Here we are. Bag. There. Two.
She runs into the bathroom.
There we are. Anyway, about 7 months ago, this so-called lawyer, Mr. O'Shaughnessy, asked me how I'd like to cheer up a lonely old man and pick up $100 a week at the same time. I told him, look, darling, you've got the wrong Holly Golightly. A girl can do as well as that on trips to the powder room. I mean, any gentleman with the slightest chic will give a girl a $50 bill for the powder room. And I always ask for cab fare, too. That's another 50. But then he told me his client was Sally Tomato. He said, dear old Sally had seen me at Elmer's or somewhere and had admired me a la distance. So wouldn't it be a good deed if I went to visit him once a week? Well, how could I say no? It was all so wildly romantic.
She steps back out.
How do I look?
Her face glows radiantly.
Very good. I must say I'm amazed.
You were a darling to help. I could never have done it without you. Bag?
Call me anytime. I'm just upstairs. Or I will be as soon as I get moved in.
Bye, Cat.
He follows her out.
You mean he gives you $100 for an hour's conversation?
Well, Mr. O'Shaughnessy does as soon as I meet him and give him the weather report.
Look, it's none of my business, but it sounds to me like you could get in a lot of trouble.
Hold this for me, will you?
In the vestibule, she puts on perfume and lipstick.
And what do you mean, weather report?
Oh, that's just a message I give Mr. O'Shaughnessy. So you know I've really been up there. Sally tells me things to say like, oh, there's a hurricane in Cuba, and it's cloudy over Palermo. Things like that. You don't have to worry. I've taken care of myself for a long time.
They step out into the sunshine. Holly Golightly wears a black, wide-brimmed hat and a black dress with fringe at the hem.
Taxi!
As she follows him into the street, a cab passes. She sticks two fingers into her mouth.
I never could do that.
It's easy.
A red and white taxi pulls up to them. The debonair man opens the passenger door, and a woman inside hands him a golden urn.
Paul. I'm late. I know it.
She exchanges a look with Holly.
Don't tell me you were locked out. Didn't you get the key? Oh, darling. I'm so sorry.
No, I got the key all right. Miss Golightly, my neighbor, was kind enough to let me in. Miss Golightly's on her way to Sing Sing. Just visiting, of course. Miss Golightly? Mrs. Phelanson, my decorator.
How do you do?
How do you do? Ooh, darling. Let me look at you.
Are you through?
Was the flight
I'm in a terrible rush. Grand Central Station and step on it, darling.
Is it really only 3 weeks since I left you in Rome? Seems like years. You seen the apartment?
Not yet.
I know it was wicked of me, but I couldn't resist. I went ahead and fixed it up without you. I think it's darling, of course, but if you absolutely hate it, we can rip everything out and start from scratch.
They enter the brownstone. Nighttime. The buck-toothed Japanese landlord sleeps on his futon on the floor. He sits up, crashing into the lamp above him. Downstairs, Holly enters her bathroom and locks the door.
Oh, come on, baby. Open the door. Oh, be a pal.
She opens the window and tries to climb onto the fire escape. Her dress is too tight to crawl out. Eyeing a robe hanging on the door, she starts to change. In the upstairs hall, Mr. Yunioshi rushes out and peers down the staircase.
Mr. Golightly! Once again, I must protest! If you don't stop with that phonograph, right this minute I'm going to go to the police department! Well, that's more better!
He bangs into his apartment door. Downstairs, dressed in a bathrobe, Holly sits on the windowsill and pulls on a pair of black flats.
Oh, come on. You're a great kid. Open the door.
Tying the terry cloth belt around her waist, she climbs the fire escape to the next level. In the ornately decorated apartment above, the blonde-haired Paul sleeps soundly in his bed, bare-chested. As Holly peeks through the window, Paul's companion, Mrs. Fallonson, steps out of the bathroom. 30-ish, she has red hair cut in a wavy bob, hazel eyes, and a shapely figure. As she passes the window, Holly ducks, then creeps to a rail and sits. She pulls the bathrobe tightly around her neck and continues to gaze inside. Mrs. Fallonson counts off several bills from a roll and places them on a desk beside a typewriter, a liquor bottle, and two empty glasses. Leaning over Paul, she tenderly kisses his cheek, then heads for the door. Holly turns to a nearby shaded window and through the sheer fabric watches her go. Then she raises the window and pushes aside the shade. Paul jerks awake.
It's all right, it's only me.
No, wait a minute, Miss...
Golightly. Holly Golightly. I live downstairs. We met this morning, remember?
Yeah.
He looks around nervously.
It's all right, she's gone. I must say, she works late hours for a decorator. The thing is, I have the most terrifying man downstairs. I mean, he's sweet when he isn't drunk, but let him start lapping up the vino, and oh, golly, kill beast. Finally got so tiresome down there, just went out the window.
She cringes, then climbs inside, shutting the window.
Look, you can throw me out if you want to, but you did look so cozy in here, and your decorator friend had gone home, and it was beginning to get a bit cold out there on the fire escape.
And I always heard people in New York never get to know their neighbors. Well, how was Sing Sing?
Fine. I made the train and everything.
And what's the weather report?
Small craft warnings, Block Island, Hatteras. Whatever that means.
They both light cigarettes.
You know, you're sweet. You really are.
She sits at the desk.
And you look a little like my brother, Fred. Do you mind if I call you Fred?
Not at all.
Leaning forward, she strokes the money.
300, she's very generous. Is it by the week, the hour, or what?
Okay, the party's over, out.
Oh, Fred. Darling Fred, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, don't be angry. I was just trying to let you know I understand. I understand completely.
It's okay. Stick around. Make yourself a drink. Throw me my robe and I'll make you one.
You stay right where you are. You must be absolutely exhausted. I mean, it is very late and you were sound asleep and everything. I suppose you think I'm very brazen or trefou or something.
I don't think you're any fooler than anybody else.
Yes, you do. Everybody does, and I don't mind. It's useful being top banana in the shock department.
She gazes around the bedroom.
What do you do, anyway?
I'm a writer, I guess.
You guess, don't you know?
Okay. Positive statement. Ringing affirmative. I'm a writer.
The only writer I've ever been out with is Benny Shacklett. He's written an awful lot of television stuff, but Kel Rat. Tell me, are you a real writer? I mean, does anybody buy what you write or publish it or anything?
They bought what's in that box.
She goes over to a corner.
Yours?
Mm-hmm.
All these books?
Well, it's just the one book. 12 copies of it.
Nine Lives by Paul Barjack. They're stories.
Mm-hmm. Nine of them.
Tell me more.
They're not the kind of stories you can really tell.
Too dirty?
I suppose they're dirty too, but only incidentally. Mainly they're angry, sensitive, intensely felt, and that dirtiest of all dirty words, promising. Or so said the Times Book Review, October 1st, 1956.
1956?
That's right.
I suppose this is kind of a ratty question, but what have you written lately?
Lately, I've been working on a novel.
Lately, since 1956?
Well, a novel takes a long time. I want to get it exactly right.
So no more stories?
Well, the idea is I'm supposed to not fritter my talent away on little things. I'm supposed to be saving it for the big one.
Tell me, do you write every day?
Sure.
Today?
Sure.
It's a beautiful typewriter.
Of course. It writes nothing but sensitive, intensely felt, promising prose.
But there's no ribbon in it.
There isn't?
No.
Oh.
Rising, she takes a sip from her drink.
You know, something you said this morning's been bothering me all day.
What's that?
Do they really give you $50 whenever you go to the powder room?
Of course.
You must do very well.
I'm trying to save, but I'm not very good at it.
Holly saunters into an alcove and pours her drink over a leafy green plant.
You know, you do look a lot like my brother Fred. I haven't seen him, of course, since I was 14. That's when I left home. And he was already 6'2". I guess it must have been the peanut butter that did it. Everybody thought he was dotty the way he gorged himself on peanut butter. But he wasn't dotty. Just sweet and vague and terribly slow.
She lies on the foot of the bed.
Poor Fred. He's in the army now. It's really the best place for him until I can get enough money saved.
And then?
And then Fred and I went to Mexico once. It's a wonderful place for raising horses. I saw one place near the sea that Fred's very good with horses. Even land in Mexico costs something. And no matter what I do, there never seems to be more than a couple of $100 in the back.
She eyes a clock.
Be 4:30. It just can't.
As smoke wafts up from her hand, she turns to Paul with a wistful look.
Do you mind if I just get in with you for a minute? It's all right. Really, it is. We're friends, that's all.
She snuggles up against him. He takes her drink.
We are friends, aren't we?
Sure.
He smiles and pats her shoulder. Puffing on his own cigarette, he slips hers out of her hand.
Okay. Let's don't say another word. Let's just go to sleep.
With his arm wrapped around her, he clicks off the light. As she sleeps against him, Paul sits up in the darkness. He glances around the room at vertical Venetian blinds separating the bedroom from the alcove and royal blue brocade paper covering one wall. Later in the night, she stirs beside him.
Where are you, Fred? It's cold.
Paul watches her sleeping, frowning face.
There's snow in the wind.
He gently shakes her.
Why are you crying?
With a start, she glances up at him, then sits up and crinkles her brow.
If we're going to be friends, let's just get one thing straight right now. I hate Snoops.
She rushes to the window, lifts it, and climbs out. He stares dumbly after her. Daytime. Paul ambles down the sidewalk, heading to the brownstone. He carries a bag of groceries with a loaf of French bread poking out. Flinging aside a cigarette, he climbs the stairs, then enters the vestibule. Inside, there's a small package taped to his mailbox with a note attached. He looks it over, then peruses the note. It reads, "Darling Fred, please forgive last night. Can you stop in for a drink tonight about 6-ish? Your friend, Holly Golightly." Smiling, he unlocks the door and steps inside. Upstairs, Paul enters his apartment, walks over to the desk, and picks up the receiver of a golden telephone.
Yeah.
Lucille, darling? 2E.
Huh?
I've been trying desperately to reach you. Bill just got back. A day early, the beast. So I'm afraid I'll have to beg off. You'll explain to the rest of the girls?
Her husband mixes a drink nearby.
You're a darling. Maybe we can have a long lunch tomorrow. I'll phone you in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Whatever you say.
And you will manage to survive without me tonight.
Sure. I might even take a wild, boyish fling at writing.
Good night.
Good night.
Sitting at the desk, he hangs up the phone, places the grocery bag on the floor, and opens the small gift box. Inside is a typewriter ribbon. He smiles and puts it aside. Now, in Holly's apartment, a cocktail party is in progress. Drink in hand, a short, 40-ish man with dark, thinning hair stares into a birdcage at a motionless green parakeet.
Hey, got yourself stuffed, huh, Polly, baby? Is that your right big mouth?
He saunters over to a beautiful blonde standing against a wall.
Buongiorno.
Huh?
Aren't you drinking?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, your pockets there or something? What do you go by?
Hmm?
What's your name? What's your name? What do you call yourself?
Irving.
Oh, yeah. Perfect, perfect. That's wonderful, Irving. I'll be right back, Irving, baby.
Mm-hmm.
With a glance back at Irving, he answers the door. Paul stands in the hallway wearing a crisp gray suit.
Yeah. Oh, kid's still in the shower. You expected?
I was invited. Is that what you mean?
Oh, now, don't get yourself all tense and sore, pal. Come on in. It's a party. There's a lot of characters coming around here that are not expected. I'll buy a drink. You drink?
Yeah.
I'll buy a drink.
Okay.
They step into the kitchen.
Hey, honey, you're a dead split, man.
What do you drink, kid?
Bourbon.
Bourbon?
Mm-hmm.
On the rocks?
Yeah.
Good.
No, with water.
All right, you want rocks first, then, don't you?
Yeah.
Good, you got it.
Not too much.
All right. Yeah, that'll set you free. You got a kid long?
Not very. I live upstairs.
You're kidding. Oh, look at this place, will you? What a place. It's unbelievable. What a dump.
Hmm? What do you think? About what?
Is she or isn't she? Wait a minute. Hold it.
He opens the door to a smiling, well-dressed couple.
There he is. JB, old John. What is that? All right. Yeah. Hello.
You know Gil?
Yeah, how are you? Good to see you.
How about
you
a drink?
Fine, in the kitchen. You'll find everything you need.
Thanks.
Holly sashays out, dressed in a bedsheet.
So, oh, honey, that is you. That is you.
Fred, darling, I'm so glad you could come.
I brought you a house present. Something in the bookcase.
Oh, you're sweet.
She sets his book on her shelf.
Doesn't that look nice? Give me a cigarette, O.J.
Sure, sure.
O.J.'s a great agent. He knows a terrific lot of phone numbers. What's Jerry Wall's phone number, O.J.?
Oh, come on, lay off.
Darling, man. I want you to call him and tell him what a genius Fred is.
Yes, I got it.
Stop blushing, Fred. You didn't say you were a genius. I did. So quit stalling, O.J. Just tell me what you're going to do to make Fred rich and famous.
Now, why don't you let Fred baby me settle that matter, huh, puppy?
Okay, but just remember, I'm the agent. He's already got a decorator. I'm the agent.
Hold it. All right, boys, come on in there. Right in the kitchen, you find everything you need.
Two young men enter. O.J. shuts the door behind them.
So listen, Fred, baby. What do you
think? No, it's Paul, baby.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I thought it was Fred, baby.
No.
Well, answer the question, though. Is she or isn't she?
Is she or isn't she what?
A phony.
I don't know. I don't think so.
You don't think so, huh? Well, you're wrong. She is. But on the other hand, you're right. Because she's a real phony. You know why? Because she honestly believes all this phony junk that she believes. I mean it. Now, look, I like the kid. I mean, I sincerely like the kid. I do. I mean, I'm sensitive. That's why. I mean, you got to be sensitive to like the kid. You know what I mean? It's a touch, a streak of the poet. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You known her long?
Are you kidding? I'm the guy that discovered. I'm O.J. Berman. A couple of years ago, back in the coast, she was just a kid. Of course, she had a lot of style, a lot of class, you know.
A lot of what?
Class. Yeah, she had a lot of class. But, of course, when she opened her mouth, you didn't know what she was talking about. She was a hillbilly Renoki. You know how long it took me to smooth out that accent?
No.
I'll tell you how long. 1 year. You know how we did it? We give her French lessons. Yeah, figured once she could imitate French, she had no trouble imitating English. And finally, when I thought she was be-reading, I arranged for a little screen test. Well, the night before the screen test, well, I could have killed myself. The night before the screen test, the phone rings, I pick it up, I said, OJ speaking. She says, this is Holly. I said, Holly, you sound so far away, honey. What's with you? She says, I'm in New York. I said, what kind of New York? You got a screen test tomorrow. She says, I'm in New York because I've never been to New York before. I said, get yourself on the plane, get back here. She says, I don't want it. I said, what do you mean you don't want it? What do you want? She says, I don't want it. I says, what do you want? She says, when I find out what I want, I'm going to let you know. Bang. So, look, Fred, baby, you know, don't tell
me. It's Paul, baby.
Paul, baby, sure. Yeah. I mean, don't tell me that she isn't a phony, you know what I mean? Irving. Honey, Irving, where you been?
OJ strolls off with the beautiful blonde. Later, the party's in full swing. In the kitchen, Kat crawls on top of the cabinets and leaps onto a man's shoulder. The partygoer carries him through the crowd. Holly, wearing a sleeveless black dress, tries a man's drink.
Say, thanks, Mike, darling. I tried reaching you all day long. But you're answering trouble, don't answer.
Gripping a 2-foot-long cigarette holder, she absentmindedly dips the lit cigarette onto a woman's tulle-wrapped hat, seated beside her. The hat begins to smolder, then bursts into flames. Paul notices from across the crowded room. Trying to get over to them, he knocks down the birdcage. No one notices the flames on the woman's hat.
Dime, darling.
What?
The dime?
Oh, yes. Do you have a watch?
No, I don't.
Oh, let me see it. 6:45.
Thank you so much.
Checking a man's watch, Holly tips his drink over the hat, dousing the fire. Paul smiles, then eyes a nearby woman's bare back. He presses his drink against her skin. She lurches out of his way. As he passes Holly, they exchange a smile. She follows him into the kitchen where he pours himself another drink. With a sly grin, she clenches her cigarette holder between her teeth.
This is some party. Who are all these people anyhow?
Who knows? The word gets out. You don't mind, do you, darling?
She sips his drink.
Reinforcements.
A delivery boy staggers in, toting a case of alcohol and groceries. As he sets the liquor down in the kitchen, merrymakers swarm around him. Holly leads Paul away from the gathering throng. At the door, a glamorous, statuesque woman in a white dress and fluffy hat stumbles in with two men.
Holly! Holly, darling!
What's that?
Mag Wildwood. She's a model, believe it or not, and a thumping bore. But just look at the goodies she brought with her.
A dashing, olive-skinned man.
He's all right, I suppose, if you like dark, handsome, rich-looking men with passionate natures and too many teeth.
I don't mean that one. I mean the other one.
A chubby, red-headed man with glasses.
The other one?
He's Rusty Trawler. Rusty Trawler. He happens to be the 9th richest man in America under 50.
Now that, indeed, is a remarkable piece of information to have at your fingertips.
I keep track of these things.
The delivery boy approaches.
Excuse me, you owe me 47...
Will you, darling?
Handing him her drink, she saunters on.
Mag, darling, what are you doing here?
Honey, I was upstairs working with Yunioshi. Easter stuff for the bazaar. Then these two nice boys came to pick me up. It was a mistake, of course. My wires got crossed somewhere. They were both very sweet about it. Now I present Jose de Silva Pereira. He's from Brazil. Miss Gogolightly.
He kisses her hand.
Very kind of you, Miss Golightly, to allow me to attend your party. I'm so interested in North American cultures. I've been already, of course, to the Statue of Liberty and to the Restaurant Automatique. But this is the first time I'm in a typical North American home.
Wouldn't he just nailed in your mouth? And this is Mr. Rusty Trawler, Miss Golightly. You're not vexed at me for bringing him.
Of course not, darling.
I'm glad. Now, who's gonna bring me up a bourbon?
OJ!
Yeah.
Would you get Miss Wildwood a drink?
Yeah, which one's Miss Wildwood?
Mr. Berman! We have been formally introduced by our Mag Wildwood from Wildwood, Arkansas. That's Hill Country.
Now, you just make yourself right at home, senor.
Oh, do not trouble yourself. I'm contented to stand observing the customs of your country.
Okay, you do that. Now, come along, Mr. Trawler. Let's see what we can find to amuse you.
They walk off hand in hand. Upstairs, Yunioshi sits cross-legged on the floor of his apartment, wiping the rim of a bowl of tea. With a pouting frown, he looks up in distress. Below, couples smoke, drink, and cha-cha in the cramped living room. Holly and Rusty dance with their foreheads pressed together. She takes a puff from her cigarette, then sticks the holder straight into the air. Crouched on a shelf above them, Kat eyes the twirling cigarette. Clutching a large drink, a brunette woman stares at her reflection in a mirror with a gleeful look. Squeezing her eyes closed, she nearly doubles over. In the wild melee around the room, the delivery boy dances with a pretty girl. Three couples huddle together. Two beautiful Asian women chat with a pudgy man. A man does a handstand against a wall. Another lifts a woman onto his shoulders. A woman's hips shimmy in a tight white dress. Back at the mirror, the brunette cries mascara-stained tears. Seated on the white suitcase, a man glances at a watch on a woman's ankle, then rises. As he moves off, Paul makes his way toward the suitcase. Nearby, a woman argues with a man wearing an eye patch.
Pick me up, and at the last minute I had Gil Kong.
Look! I wasn't supposed to pick you up.
He lifts the patch and glares with both eyes. On the floor, Paul grabs the phone out of the suitcase.
Yes.
Miss Goldie, this time I'm warning you! I am definitely this time going to call in the police!
Cringing, Paul hangs up and drops the phone back in the suitcase. As he rests on all fours, a man sits on his back. Paul takes out his cigarette, lifts the man's shoe, and uses the heel to put it out. He rises from beneath the other man, who beams and shakes his hand. The olive-skinned Jose approaches.
Is it something important?
Nah, just the guy upstairs, complaining about the noise.
He's angry.
Well, he did mention something about calling the police.
Oh, the police. The police.
Oh, that I cannot help.
Well, I'd better look for Miss Wildwood and go.
Nearby, Mag corners Rusty and Holly.
You think I'd find a bowman mousing after a piece of cheap Hollywood trash?
Mag, darling, you're being a bore.
Shut up! You know what's gonna happen to you? I am gonna march you over to the zoo and feed you to the yak. As soon as I finish this drink.
Gulping, Mag drains her cup. She teeters for a moment, her eyes glazing over. With a look of alarm, Holly cups her hand around her mouth.
Timber!
Mag falls to the floor, face down. Upstairs, a startled Yunioshi drops his tea bowl. Back at the party, guests step around the unconscious Mag and continue to dance. With a conspiratorial smile, Holly follows Rusty out the front door, unseen by the others. Nearby, Jose confers with Paul. The Brazilian jerks his head up and cocks his ear. Paul gestures for him to stay put. Then, pushing aside revelers, he clears a path to the window, throws open the shutters, and gazes down at the sidewalk. Below, several uniformed officers hop out of a police car as Holly and Rusty step out of the building. They question them. Grinning, Holly points to her apartment. As the policemen rush inside, Holly and Rusty stroll off. Back upstairs, Paul watches with a worried look. Pinching and prodding partygoers out of his way, he darts back to Jose and mouths the words, "Follow me." Paul grabs a heavyset woman and dances her across the room, leading them through the crowd, down the hallway. In the bedroom, a cute redhead hops onto Paul's back. Jose pulls her off. As she squirms in Jose's arms, Paul steps up to the bathroom door. Paul grabs the woman and throws her onto another man's back. Opening the door, he yanks Jose into the bathroom, then rips aside the shower curtain, revealing OJ in the tub smooching with Irving.
Oh. Oh, good evening, Ed.
It's Paul, baby.
Oh, yes.
You remember Irving, don't you?
Yeah, hi, Irving.
That's Jose.
Jose.
They step around the couple and climb out a window.
Jewel thief.
On the fire escape, the men shake hands. Paul scrambles up to his apartment. Jose heads for the sidewalk. Through the windows, we see policemen entering the apartment. Daytime. A train speeds down tracks. Now, in a visiting room at Sing Sing, guards roam between crowded tables packed with prisoners and their guests. Holly and Paul sit across from a large-nosed man with a cleft chin who studies a notepad.
Sally helps me with my accounts. I have no head for figures at all. I'm trying desperately to save some money. You know, I told you. I just can't seem to. He makes me write down everything in there. What I get, what I spend. I used to have a checking account, but he made me get rid of that. He feels, for me anyway, that it's better to operate on a cash basis, tax-wise.
Someday, Mr. Friend, you take this book, turn into a novel. Everything is there. Just fill in a little of the details.
Certainly would be good for some laughs.
No. No, I don't think so. This is a book that would break the heart. Mr. Fitzsimmons, powder room, $50. Less $18, repair one black satin dress, cat food, 27 cents.
Sally, darling, please stop. You're making me blush. But you're right about Jack Fitzsimmons. He's an absolute rat. I guess, of course, I don't really know anybody but rats. Except, of course, Fred here.
She throws him a smile.
You do think Fred is nice, don't you, Sally?
For you, I hope he is.
Behind a desk, a guard pockets a whistle. Prisoners and their visitors reluctantly stand. Holly offers Sally her hand.
Goodbye, Uncle Sally. Till next week.
He kisses her hand.
Goodbye, Uncle Sally.
Goodbye, and don't forget to send that book, eh?
I won't.
Sally turns to go.
Oh, what about the weather report?
Oh, yes. Snow flurry is expected this weekend in New Orleans.
He blows her a kiss, then leaves.
Snow flurry is expected this weekend in New Orleans. Isn't that just the weirdest? I bet they haven't had snow in New Orleans for a million years. I don't know how he thinks them up.
Later, Paul sits at his desk. A piece of paper inside his typewriter reads, "My friend. There was once a very lovely, very frightened girl. She lived alone, except for a nameless cat." He turns to the window, raises it, and looks down. Holly sits in the fire escape below, strumming a guitar. She wears jeans and a sweatshirt with a towel wrapped around her head.
Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To drifters off to see the world, there's such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend.
She gazes up at him with a warm smile.
Hi.
Hi.
What you doing?
Writing.
Good.
He waves goodbye, crosses to the door, and opens it. Mrs. Fallonson stands in the hallway.
Well, hello.
She grimaces.
What's wrong?
I don't know. It's probably nothing. I want to see if he's still there.
See if who's still there? What are you talking about?
He joins her at the window.
Look.
Paul pushes aside the shade. They both peek out. On the sidewalk, a man leans against a tree, smoking.
See? I noticed him yesterday afternoon. I didn't say anything. I didn't want to sound neurotic, but when he's there again today...
What do you think he is?
Could be anybody, of course, but what crossed my mind was, suppose Bill's having us watched, huh?
They exchange a long look.
Okay, I'll take care of this.
No, no, don't, please. Look, if that's what it is, you'll only make everything worse.
I'll be careful. You wait here.
Darling, please don't. I don't think you should.
Now, take it easy. I just want to find out what this is all about.
He walks out. She strides to the window and peers through the thin shade. On the brownstone steps, Paul walks out of the entrance, takes a pack of cigarettes out of his pocket, puts one in his mouth, and lights it. As he turns down the sidewalk, the man follows him with his eyes. Tall and gray-haired, he has a ruddy complexion and bushy eyebrows. He wears a light gray suit, plain blue tie, and a tanned fedora. Taking a puff, he saunters after the younger man. Moments later, in Central Park, Paul stands beside a pond watching a toy sailboat glide past. All around him, adults and children stroll along a walkway and recline on benches. Turning, he spies the man at a concession stand buying a box of Cracker Jack. The gray-haired man pays the cashier and gazes into the distance. With a determined stride, he opens the box and follows Paul across a grassy slope at a distance. A little later, Paul's long shadow precedes him down the other side of the hill. Stopping for a moment, he glances over his shoulder. The gray-haired man appears at the crest of the hill, ambling toward him. Paul continues on. Later still, Paul sits alone on a row of benches, one arm casually resting along the bench top. The gray-haired man heads straight for him, munching his caramel-covered popcorn. He sits down beside Paul and rests his elbows on top of the bench. Paul glances tensely over his shoulder, then turns to face him.
All right, what do you want?
Son, I need a friend.
Chewing a piece of Cracker Jack, he reaches into his breast pocket, takes out a brown leather wallet, and pulls out a creased black and white snapshot.
That's me. That's her. That's her brother Fred.
With a stunned look, Paul takes the photo. In it, a very young Holly stands on the porch of a country house with a man and four girls.
You're Holly's father?
Her name ain't Holly. She was Lula Mae Barnes. Was till she married me. I'm her husband, Doc O'Lightly.
He holds out his hand. Paul shakes it.
Paul Varjak.
I'm a horse doctor, animal man. Do some farming, too, near Tulip, Texas. Her brother Fred's getting out of the army soon. Lula Mae belongs home with her husband, her brother, and her children.
Children?
Them's her children.
She's got four children.
Now, son, I didn't claim they was her natural born children. Their own precious mother, precious woman, passed away July the 4th, Independence Day 1955, the year of the drought. When I married Lula Mae, she was going on 14. Now, you might think the average person going on 14 wouldn't know their own mind. But you take Lula Mae, she was an exceptional person.
Doc offers his box of Cracker Jack. Paul takes it and reaches inside.
I'll tell you, son, she just plumb broke our hearts when she ran off like she done. Just plain had no reason. All the housework was done by her daughter. Lula Mae could just take it easy. I tell you, that woman got positively fat. Well, her brother, he growed up into a giant. It's a sight different from the way they come to us. A couple of wild youngins they was. I caught them outside the house stealing milk and turkey eggs. Lula Mae and her brother had been living with some mean, no-account people about 100 miles east of Tulip. She had good cause to run off from that house. Never had none to leave mine.
What about her brother? Didn't he leave, too?
No, sir. We had Fred with us till he took him in the army. That's what I come to talk to her about. I had a letter from him. He's getting out of the army in February. That's why I got on a Greyhound bus to come to get her. Lula Mae's place is with her husband, her children, and her brother.
Paul shows him a tin ring.
Huh?
It's prize in the Cracker Jack. You want it?
Uh-uh. Never could understand why that woman ran off. Don't tell me she wasn't happy. Talky as a jaybird she was. With something smart to say on every subject. Better than the radio.
After I proposed, I cried like a baby. She said, what do you want to cry for, Doc? Of course we'll be married. I've never been married before. Well, I had to laugh and hug and squeeze it. Never been married before.
Paul gazes at him warily.
Listen, son. I advise you I need a friend. Because I don't want to surprise her or scare her none. Be my friend. Let her know I'm here.
Shoving his hands into his pockets, Paul turns away. As he stands with his back to Doc, the older man gazes at him with a knotted brow.
Will you do that for me, son?
Paul turns back to face him.
Yeah, sure, Doc. That's what you want. Come on.
Doc follows him, tossing the rest of his Cracker Jack onto the ground for several pigeons. Later, in Holly's apartment, Holly Golightly wears a chic black dress and pillbox hat.
Coming!
She goes to the door. Paul stands in the hallway.
Oh, darling. I'm just on my way out. I was supposed to be at 21 half an hour ago. Maybe you can have a drink or something tomorrow, huh?
Sure, little mate. If you're still here tomorrow.
Mouth slightly agape, she pulls off her sunglasses.
Oh, please, where is he? Fred?
She goes to the staircase.
Fred?
Doc waits at the bottom.
Gosh. Who's me?
Awestruck, he climbs up to her, taking off his hat.
Gee, honey, don't they feed you up here? You're so skinny.
She squeezes his shoulder and kisses his cheek.
Hi, Doc.
Kingdom come.
Sweeping her into his arms, he carries Holly into the apartment. As the door shuts behind them, Paul moves away with a melancholy look. He stops for a moment, slightly hanging his head, then slowly climbs the steps to his apartment. Later, Mrs. Fallonson exits the brownstone. Crooking her thumbs into the pockets of her cape, she strides to the curb and hails a cab. With a longing look, she glances back at the building and waves to Paul. From the window, he watches her climb into the taxi, then pull away. He turns away and leans against the window. He marches into the bedroom and lifts the window shade. Holly crouches on the fire escape outside, wearing a trench coat. Paul opens the window, then sits on the sill beside her and holds her hand.
What is it? What's the matter? Are you all right?
I guess so. No, I'm not. Fred, will you help me?
If I can.
I want you to come to the bus station with us, Doc and me.
What?
He still thinks I'm going back with him. I need support. I don't think I can play the scene alone.
Well, Holly, what can I do? He's your husband.
No, he's not.
He's not?
It was annulled ages ago, but he just won't accept it. Please, Fred. I'll tell him you're coming to see us off. Don't say anything.
She kisses his cheek.
Just meet us out front in about an hour. Please?
She turns to go. Later, Holly, Doc, and Paul stroll into a bus station.
You wait right here, honey. I'll get the bag.
He walks off.
Why don't I get some magazines?
Please, Fred. Don't leave me.
Leaving from platform 5.
They follow Doc to a row of lockers where he removes his bag.
Come on, Lulu May, that's us.
Doc, I'm not coming with you. Come on. Let's walk together quietly and I'll try and help you understand. Help me talk to him, Fred.
That's all right, son. I appreciate you want to help, but it's between Lulu May and me.
Sure, Doc.
Paul steps away.
I love you, Lulu May.
I know you do, and that's just the trouble. It's a mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing. You were always lugging home wild things. Once it was a hawk with a broken wing, and another time it was a full-grown wildcat with a broken leg. Remember?
Lulu May, there's something...
You mustn't give your heart to a wild thing. The more you do, the stronger they get, until they're strong enough to run into the woods or fly into a tree, and then to a higher tree, and then to the sky.
Lulu, there's something I gotta tell you.
Excuse me? A couple of weeks ago, I got a letter from young Fred.
Fred? He's all right, isn't he?
Yeah, he's fine, I guess. He's getting out of the army in February. That's what he wrote to tell me.
In February? Well, it's only 4 months.
So you see, you gotta come back with me, Lula Mae. Your place is with me and your children and your brother.
Doc, you gotta understand I can't come back.
And you gotta understand what I'm trying to tell you. I don't want it to seem like I'm pressuring you none, but now I gotta. If you don't come back with me, I'm gonna have to write young Fred and tell him that unless he wants to look out for himself, he better sign up for another hitch.
Doc, don't you do that. Don't you write that to him. I'll write to him myself and tell him I want him here with me. I'll take care of him. Don't you worry.
You're talking crazy, Lula Mae.
Doc, stop calling me that. I'm not Lula Mae anymore.
She hugs him tightly, pressing her cheek against his chest.
All right, Lula Mae. I guess you know what you're doing.
He pulls away. She reluctantly releases him. With a pained expression, Doc steps over to Paul.
Keep an eye on her, will you, son? At least see she eats something once in a while.
Sure, Doc.
Doc glances back at Holly.
Skinny.
Carrying his bag, he heads to the bus, climbs on, and finds a seat. Holly follows him with a concerned look and knocks on the tinted window beside him. He opens it up and gazes down at her. Tears shining in her eyes, she rubs his hand, which rests on the window frame.
Please, Doc, please understand. I love you, but I'm just not Lula Mae anymore.
He eyes her doubtfully.
I'm not.
As the bus starts to pull away, her hand slowly slips from his. With a furrowed brow and a steady gaze, he watches her as the bus backs up for a moment, then lurches forward, veers around a corner, and speeds down a darkened street. A tear trickles along her cheek as she stares after him. Her brow knits remorsefully, and she hangs her head. Paul comes up beside her.
You know the terrible thing, Fred, darling? I am still Lula Mae. 14 years old, stealing turkey eggs and running through a briar patch.
She dabs her face with his handkerchief.
Except now I call it having the mean reds.
Holly wipes her eyes and gives it back to him, then snatches his cigarette and takes a puff.
Still too early to go to Tiffany's. I guess the next best thing is a drink. Yes, I very much need a drink. Will you buy me one, Fred, darling?
Sure.
She takes his arm.
Only promise me one thing. Don't take me home until I'm drunk. Until I'm very drunk indeed.
Now in a smoke-filled nightclub. Lit by a spotlight, a stripper steps to the front of a stage, spreading her bright red cape. She wears a skin-tight white dress, flared at the bottom, and stiletto heels. As she swirls around, her cape flashes across our view like a theater curtain. It draws back, revealing Paul and Holly sitting at the bar, staring flatly at the show.
Do you think she's talented? Deeply and importantly talented?
No. Amusingly and superficially talented, yes, but deeply and importantly, no.
Holly's eyes grow wide.
Gracious! Do you think she's handsomely paid?
Oh, indeed.
Well, let me tell you something, mister. If I had her money, I'd be richer than she is.
How do you figure that?
Because I keep the candy store.
Hmm?
Old Sally Tomato, that's my candy store. I'd always keep Sally. And that's why I'd be richer than she is.
We'd better get a little more air.
Taking her by the shoulders, he helps her up. She follows him out, swiveling her hips to the beat. Later, they enter their brownstone's vestibule.
Every Tom, Dick, and Sid, Harry was his friend. Anyway, every Tom, Dick, and Sid thinks that if he takes a girl to dinner, she'll just curl up like a kitten in a little furry ball at his feet. Right? I have, by actual count, been taken to dinner by 26 different rats in the last 2 months. 27 if you count Benny Shackley, who's in many ways a super rat.
I think I forgot my key.
Never mind, I just buzzed Junie Oshi.
Oh.
Do you want to know something funny?
Mm-hmm.
In spite of the fact that most of these rats fork up $50 for the powder room like little dolls, I find I have again by actual count $9 less in the old bank account than I had 6 months ago.
They stumble into the foyer.
So, my darling Fred, I have tonight made a very serious decision.
And what is that?
No longer will I play the field.
Congratulations.
The field stinks, both economically and socially. And I'm giving it up.
What?
Miss Kulani, this time I'm not only calling the police, but the fire department and the New York State Housing Commission. And if necessary, the Board of Health.
Quiet up there. You want to wake the whole house?
Paul carries her to her apartment.
As Miss Golightly was saying before she was so rudely interrupted, Miss Golightly further announces her intentions to devote her not inconsiderable talents to the immediate capture for the purpose of matrimony of Mr. Rutherford. Rusty to his friends, of whom I'm sure he has many. Trawler.
Who?
Rusty Trawler. You met him at my party a couple of weeks ago. He came with Mag Wildwood. Not the beautiful Latin type. The other one. The one that looks like a pig.
She puffs out her cheeks.
Remember? The 9th richest man in America under 50? Ah. Do I detect a look of disapproval in your eye? Tough beans, buddy. Because that's the way it's gonna be. I can't.
Holly, you're drunk.
True.
Nodding, she starts to climb the kitchen cabinets.
True. True,
what are you doing?
So I think we should have a drink to the new Mrs. Rusty Trawler. Me.
Hey, take it easy.
What's the matter? Don't you think I can do it? Tell me. Seriously, I'm interested. Don't you think I can? You heard the doc. My brother gets out of the army in February and the doc won't take him back. So it's all up to me. I don't know why you don't understand. I need money. And I'll do whatever I have to do to get it. So, this time next month, I'll be the new Mrs. Rusty Trawler. And I think we should have a little drink to that.
She clutches an empty bottle.
It's all gone. Isn't that too bad? Got any whiskey upstairs?
He nods.
But you've had enough.
Go ahead, get the whiskey. I'll pay you for it.
She staggers to her purse.
Holly, please.
No, you disapprove of me. And I do not accept drinks from gentlemen who disapprove of me. I can pay for my own whiskey, and don't you forget it.
Holly.
Do not accept drinks from disapproving gentlemen. Especially not disapproving gentlemen who are kept by other ladies. So take it. You should be used to taking money from ladies by now.
Seated on the floor, a bill slips out of her fingers.
If I were you, I'd be more careful with my money. Rusty Trawler is too hard a way of earning it.
She straightens her swaying figure.
It should take you exactly 4 seconds to cross from here to that door. I'll give you 2.
He stands over her a moment, then turns away, pressing a cigarette between his lips. At the door, Paul throws Holly 1 last look, then walks out. She stares after him with a pouting gaze. Blinking back tears, she squeezes her eyes shut and hangs her head. Daytime. A mailman walks out of the brownstone. Inside the foyer, Paul climbs the staircase while opening an envelope. He stops midway, takes out a folded piece of stationery, and opens it. The letterhead reads Western Review, and inside is a check made out to him for $50. With a grin, he pockets it and hops up to the landing, perusing the letter. He stops in front of Holly's apartment and reaches for the buzzer. Glancing down, he notices a bottle of milk and a newspaper beside the doormat. He picks them up. The headline reads, Rusty Trawler Takes Fourth, above a photo of a beaming Rusty and his plump bride. Holly opens the door wearing earplugs and draped with a robe.
Hi. I came up to talk to you about the other night.
And I saw the paper and, well, actually I'm kind of embarrassed about it. But since it concerns you, I thought I'd talk to you about it in person.
What?
What? The earplugs. I can't go through the whole thing again.
Sufficient to say, I've come to make up. And as an added inducement, I have all kinds of news.
Can I come in?
I guess so. Just a minute. Do I have a nightgown on? No, I don't. Would you mind turning around for a second? Oh, never mind. It's such a corny line anyway. I'll turn around myself. Come in.
Turning, she puts on the robe.
Have you seen the paper?
Rusty, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I know all about it. Certainly had him pegged wrong, didn't I? I thought he was just a rat. But he was a super rat all along. A super rat in rat's clothing. You don't even know the best part. Not only was he a rat, or a super rat, rather, he was also broke. Broke? I mean, but not a farthing. His family has money, of course, but he personally is broke. It turns out he owes $700,000. Can you imagine anyone owing $700,000? $43, yes. Anyway, that's why he decided to marry the queen of the pig people. I'll tell you one thing, Fred, darling. I'd marry you for your money in a minute. Would you marry me for my money?
In a minute.
So I guess it's pretty lucky neither of us is rich, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, Fred, darling, I'm so glad to see you.
She kisses him on the lips, then pulls back and composes herself.
What have you been doing?
Writing, mostly. Sold a story. Just got word this morning.
Oh, that's marvelous. It really is. But only how does your decorator friend feel about it? I thought you were supposed to be saving yourself and all of that.
You know something? I haven't quite got around to telling her about it yet. Look, why don't we go out and have a drink or take a walk or something to celebrate?
All right. I think there's some champagne in the icebox. Why don't you open it while I get dressed?
Okay. I don't think I've ever drunk champagne before breakfast before. With breakfast on several occasions. But never before.
Now, I've got a wonderful idea. We could spend the whole day doing things we've never done before. We'll take turns. For something you've never done, then me. Of course, I can't really think of anything I've never done.
She heads for the bedroom. Stripping a bottle, he unwraps the gold foil seal, then pops the cork.
Whoa!
Foamy champagne arcs out, spilling on the floor. Later, Holly and Paul meander hand in hand down a busy New York street.
I've never been for a walk in the morning before. At least not since I've been in New York. I've walked up Fifth Avenue at 6, but as far as I'm concerned, that's still night. Do you think it counts?
Sure it counts. Now we're even.
The pedestrian signal light changes to walk. They cross the street. Later, they step through brown-tinted revolving doors into a large store and look around.
Don't you just love it?
Love what?
Tiffany's.
Around them, mahogany-paneled walls rise 30 feet high. Salesmen stand behind glass counters as shoppers mill about the store.
Isn't it wonderful? Do you see what I mean? How nothing bad could ever happen to you in a place like this? It isn't that I give a hoot about jewelry, except diamonds, of course.
They approach a case.
Like that?
Inside, a necklace of brilliant diamonds gleams on a display prop.
What do you think?
Well,
of course, personally, I think it'd be tacky to wear diamonds before I'm 40.
Well, you're right. But in the meantime, you should have something.
I'll wait.
No, I'm going to buy you a present. You bought me one, a typewriter ribbon, and it brought me luck.
All right, but Tiffany's going to be pretty expensive.
I've got my check and $10.
Oh, I wouldn't let you cash a check. What a present for $10 or under.
that I'll accept. Of course, I don't exactly know what we're going to find at Tiffany's for $10.
Stepping up to a counter, they pass an arrangement of decorative plates and candelabra. A balding, dour-faced salesman approaches.
May I help you?
Perhaps. Actually, we were looking for a present for the lady.
Certainly, sir. Is there something special you had in mind?
Well, we had considered diamonds. Now, I don't want to offend you, but the lady feels that diamonds are tacky for her.
Oh, I think they're divine on older women, but I don't think they'd be right for me. You do understand?
Certainly.
In all fairness, I think I ought to explain there is also a secondary problem, one of finance. We can only afford to spend a limited amount.
May I ask how limited?
$10.
$10?
That was the outside figure, yes.
I see.
Do you have anything for $10?
Well, frankly, madam, within that price range, the variety of merchandise is rather limited. However, I do think we might have, let me see, strictly as a novelty, you understand, for the lady and gentleman who has everything, a sterling silver telephone dialer at $6.75, including tax.
Sterling silver telephone dialer?
Yes, sir, at $6.75, including federal tax.
Well, the price is right, but I must say, I'd rather hope for something slightly more, how shall I say it, romantic in feeling. What do you think?
As sterling silver telephone dialers go, I certainly think it's handsome, but you do understand.
Well, we tried, but I guess we could have something engraved, couldn't we?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, indeed. The only problem is you would more or less have to buy something first, if only in order to have some object upon which to place the engraving. You see the difficulty.
Well, we could have this engraved, couldn't we? I think it would be very smart.
The tin ring.
This, I take it, was not purchased at Tiffany's?
No. Actually, it was purchased concurrent with, well, actually came inside of, well, a box of Cracker Jack.
I see. Do they still really have prizes in Cracker Jack boxes?
Oh, yes.
That's nice to know. It gives one a feeling of solidarity, almost of continuity with the past, that sort of thing.
Do you think Tiffany's would really engrave it for us? I mean, you don't think they would feel it was beneath them or anything like that?
Well, it is rather unusual, madam. But I think you'll find that Tiffany's is very understanding. If you will tell me what initials you would like, I think we could have something ready for you in the morning.
Holly kisses the salesman's cheek.
Didn't I tell you this was a lovely case?
Now they stand outside a store window on Fifth Avenue. Heading for the corner, they gaze up at the entrance to a library flanked by stone lions and adorned with marble columns. Inside, they saunter past a row of card catalogs.
What is this place, anyway?
You said you wanted to sit down. It's the public library. You never been here?
No. That makes two for me. I don't see any books.
They're in there.
They tiptoe into a nearby reading room.
See?
Wrapping his arm around her, he leads her back to a card catalog.
Each one of these little drawers is stuffed with little cards. And each little card is a book or an author. V-A-R-J-A-K.
Really?
She riffles through a drawer.
Look! Isn't it marvelous? There you are, right in the public library. Bar Jack Paul, Nine Lives. And then a lot of numbers. You think they really have the book itself? Live?
Follow me.
He pulls out the drawer and takes it to a man behind a counter. A little later, they sit near a librarian watching numbers light up on a board.
57. That's us.
57, please. Nine Lives by Bar Jack Paul. Did you ever read it? It's absolutely marvelous.
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
Well, you should. He wrote it. He's Bar Jack Paul in person. She doesn't believe me. Show her your driver's license or diner's club card or something. Honest, he really is the author. Cross my heart and kiss my elbow.
Would you kindly lower your voice, miss?
Why don't you autograph to them? Didn't think it'd be nice? Sort of make it more personal?
Really, miss,
Go ahead. Don't be so stuck up. Autograph it to them.
All right. What shall I say?
Something sentimental, I think.
What are you doing? Stop that!
Shh.
You're defacing public property.
Well, all right, if that's the way you feel. Come on, Fred, darling, let's get out of here. I don't think this place is half as nice as Tiffany's.
He shuts the book and drops it on the counter. They walk out arm in arm. Later, they stand outside a dime store. A Halloween display fills the window in front of them. She leans close to his ear.
Hey, did you ever steal anything from a 5 and 10? When you were a kid, I mean?
No. I'm the sensitive, bookish type. Did you?
I used to. I still do every now and then, sort of to keep my hand in. Come on, don't be chicken. Anyway, you've never done it, and it's your turn.
She pulls him into the store. Inside, she unbuttons her coat as they pass a table piled high with bags of candy. They eye it carefully, then exchange a glance. Holly shakes her head no. They move on. Gliding alongside another table, Holly runs her hand across various items. Index cards, brightly colored pencils and pens, notebook paper, and cosmetic cases. They turn a corner and stop beside a collection of toy horns. She picks up an orange one. Nearby, a brown-haired checkout girl shoots them a cold glance. Raising her eyebrows, Holly puts the horn to her lips. A customer jerks his head up. The checkout girl glares. With a sly smile to Paul, Holly puts it back. They head to another table. A burly store detective stands behind them. With their backs facing him, he glances in their direction. Holly turns, clutching a rolling pin. She spots the detective, pretends to examine the pin, then shows it to Paul. He puts it back on the table. They move on. They sidle up behind the detective to a row of lampshades. Throwing him a smile, Holly puts one on her head, shows Paul, then takes it off. The detective turns away with a stoic expression. Next, they saunter to a wire shelf stacked with goldfish bowls. Kneeling, Holly fits her brown fur hat over one. She stands and turns toward Paul, who opens up his trench coat to stealthily grab the bowl. She spies the detective watching them and puts it back. Paul pretends to shake out his trench coat. She fans herself with the hat as they stroll over to another table lined with Halloween masks. They each pick one up and fit them over their faces. Paul has a scarecrow. Holly has Huckleberry Hound. Gazing over their shoulders, they spot the detective on the other side of the store, chatting with a mother and daughter. They put the masks back and select two others. Holly chooses a yellow cat. Paul picks a droopy-eared dog. They surreptitiously put them on, then, bowing their heads, start for the exit. As they walk hand in hand, with the masks over their faces, Holly glances back at the detective. Stepping outside, they slowly amble to the corner, shoot one last look at the store, then break into a run. Wildly crossing the street, they speed up to a uniformed policeman on the opposite corner. He watches them go with a curious glance. Later, they race down a sidewalk approaching their brownstone.
I can't see.
As they dash into the vestibule, she droops against the inner door. They each take out their keys, then glance up with the chains dangling from their fingers. Paul lifts his mask away from his face. Holly slides hers on top of her head. Smiling tentatively, she gazes at him. He steps toward her, leans in, and kisses her deeply on the lips. Her green eyes close as she falls into his embrace, with the cat mask covering her hair. Morning. Wearing pajamas, Paul rolls across the crumpled sheets of his bed. With his face buried in a pillow, he opens one blue eye and sees a bronze statuette. It grips the cat mask, with the dog mask covering its face. Paul smiles to himself, fidgets for a moment, then throws aside the covers and sits up. A little later, he stands on the fire escape outside Holly's bathroom window, dressed in street clothes and the dog mask. Inside, Kat sits on the bed. Paul lifts his mask, raises the window, climbs inside, and enters the adjacent bedroom. He strokes Kat's ear.
Hi, Kat. Ready the house at home? Holly? Holly?
He looks around the rest of the apartment. It's empty. He goes to the front door, opens it up, and just misses Mrs. Follinson, who breezes down the hallway. He ducks back inside, speeds to the bathroom window, and flies up the fire escape steps. On the landing above, outside his apartment, Mrs. Follinson takes out her key and starts to put it in the lock. Paul flings the door open. Huffing and puffing, he fits the mask over his face.
Trick or treat.
You're crazy. You know that, don't you? But I love you anyway.
Tui.
Yeah?
I've got to talk to you.
All right.
He lifts the mask onto his head, walks to a cabinet, and opens it.
You want a drink?
Huh. This is going to be a serious discussion, and suddenly I'm terribly afraid it is. You're going to have to take off that ridiculous mask. Or else I'm going to have to wear one, too.
Tui, look, please.
As she holds the cat mask up to her face, he removes his.
What's the matter? Girl trouble? Is that it, darling? Oh, I see. Well, that's not so serious. As a matter of fact, I've been expecting it. I can't say I like it, but I've been expecting it. Who is she?
Hasn't got anything to do with her. This is between you and me.
Oh, then it is serious. Well, now.
Tui, you're a very stylish girl. Can't we end this stylishly?
End it?
Yes.
I do believe love has found Andy Hardy. Let's see. A waitress? A sales girl? No. She'd have to be someone rich, wouldn't she, Paul? Someone who could help you.
Curiously enough, she's a girl who can't help anyone, not even herself. The thing is, I can help her. And it's a nice feeling for a change.
All right. I understand.
She crosses to the desk.
I'll tell you what, Paul. I am a very stylish girl.
What are you doing?
Writing a check. Don't look so bewildered. Surely you've noticed me writing checks before. Pay to the order of poor Varjak, $1,000. Take her away somewhere for a week. You're entitled to a vacation with pay. Simply a matter of fair labor practice, darling. Of course, if you were really smart, you'd get some of the other boys together and organize a union. That way you'd get all the fringe benefits. Hospitalization, a pension plan, and unemployment insurance when you're... how shall I put it? Between engagements?
She holds up the check and grins.
Thanks for making it easier for me.
Don't be ridiculous, darling. Take the check and call your girl.
No thanks. I've got a check of my own.
In the huge closet, he puts on a sport coat.
When you get yourself a new writer to help, try and find one my size. That way, you won't have to even shorten the sleeves.
He strides out. She stares after him, her smile crushed, crumpling the check in her hand. Blazers of every shade hang in the closet behind her. Now, Paul steps out of Tiffany's, tossing a ring box into the air and catching it one-handed. He flicks it open. Inside, on a tiny bed of blue velvet, rests the engraved Cracker Jack ring, a simple tin band. Back at Holly's apartment, Kat sits alone on the sofa. In a phone booth on the sidewalk, Paul reluctantly hangs up the receiver and steps out. Hands in his pockets, he strolls off. Further down the street, he lights a cigarette, then spots a chicly dressed, slender brunette with sunglasses and a scarf over her head. Clutching a book, she rushes up the public library steps. He tears after her.
Holly!
As he sprints down a walkway, a flock of pigeons scatters in all directions.
Hey!
Oh, what are you doing?
Excuse me. Sorry. You look just like a girl I know named Holly.
Really?
I'm sorry.
With a sheepish look, he brushes several locks of hair off his forehead and backs away. She moves on. He enters the library. Inside, he adjusts his tie and enters the reading room. Glancing around, his mouth drops open. Holly sits at the end of one of the tables, perusing a book. He squints at her, then strolls up behind her chair. As she reads intently, he reaches down and pecks her earlobe. She eyes him for a moment, then sullenly turns back to her book. He frowns.
What do you want?
I want to talk to you.
He takes a seat.
I'm busy.
What are you doing?
Reading.
South America, land of wealth and promise.
It's very interesting.
Let's get out of here. I said, let's get out of here. I want to talk to you.
Shh.
Paul glares at a nearby patron.
What's the matter with you anyway? What's happened?
Fred, would you please just leave me alone?
Holly, I love you.
He holds her hands. She trembles slightly with terrified eyes, then rises and walks away.
Where are you going?
To the ladies' room.
He strides after her.
What's the matter with you anyway?
Let me go.
No.
Fred, please let me go.
Let's get something straight. I am not now, nor have I ever been Fred. Nor am I Benny Shacklett, whoever he may be. My name is Paul. Paul Varjak, and I love you.
Let me go.
Not till we get this settled. Now, what's all this jazz about South America?
I thought if I'm going to marry a South American, I'd better find out something about the country.
Marry what South American?
Jose.
Who the hell's Jose?
Jose de Silva Pereira.
Who the hell's Jose de Silva Pereira?
Darling, you met him. I know you did. Mag Wildwood's friend. The tall, good-looking one who came to the party with Rusty. Well, my dear, you won't believe this, but it turns out not only is he handsome and wildly rich, he's absolutely cuckoo for me.
You're crazy.
What, do you think you own me?
That's exactly what I think.
I know, that's what everybody always thinks, but everybody happens to be wrong.
Well, I am not everybody. Or am I? Is that what you really think? And I'm no different from all your other rats and super rats? Wait a minute. That's it.
He takes out his check.
If that's what you really think, there's something I want to give you.
He hands it to her.
What's that?
$50 for the powder room.
He walks away. Holly stares after Paul, her eyes rimmed with tears. Quivering, she hangs her head. Now, a cloud of steam rises out of a large metal tub. Emerging from the vapor, Yuniyoshi clenches a bar of soap. Glowering, he waves away steam, grips the sides of the tub, and rises out of the water. On the staircase below, Holly ascends with Jose. She clutches a brightly colored banderillero stick.
I wouldn't ask you in, except the place is in such a mess I couldn't bear to face it alone.
No, you have a message.
He bends over.
No?
She spears the note and picks it up. He grins.
Holly.
It's a telegram. Using the point of her banderillero, she starts to open it. Turning, they both notice water dripping onto the banister. They look up and find Yuniyoshi wrapped in a bathrobe on his landing two floors above. Droplets spill down his scowling face.
Good evening, Mr. Yuniyoshi.
Paul heads down the stairs toward them.
Oh, good evening, Paul.
Good evening.
Jose waves to Yuniyoshi.
Good evening.
Then follows Holly into her apartment. Carrying a wastebasket, Paul ambles to the landing below and passes her door. Jose flies out of the apartment.
Please, you must help me.
Inside, Holly smashes perfume bottles, knocking Cat off her vanity table.
Holly!
Paul rushes into the bedroom and tries to restrain her as she throws a lamp to the floor. Struggling to free herself from his grasp, she snatches a pillow off the bed and shakes its feathers loose. As the feathers flit around the room like giant snowflakes, she grows still and trembles in his arms. He lifts her onto the bed and gently lays her down. Covering her face with her hands, she sobs into a pillow.
No.
As he delicately caresses her shoulder, her hands fall away from her tear-streaked face. Paul gazes down at her with a sympathetic grimace, then glances toward the next room and strides to the door, carefully closing it behind him. In the hallway, he grabs Jose's elbow.
What'd you do to her?
Nothing. There was a telegram and then this. Crushing everything, conducting like crazy. It's appalling. I can't have a public scandal. It's too delicate. My name, my position, my family. Will there be the police again, you think?
I don't see why. There's no law against busting up your own apartment. Where is the telegram?
There it is.
He crosses to the sofa, picks up the telegram, and hands it to Paul, who uncrumples it and reads.
Receive notice, young Fred killed. In Jeep accident, Fort Riley, Kansas. Your husband and children join in the sorrow of our mutual loss. Letter following, love, Doc. Brother Fred.
Oh. His brother, was she very close to him?
Yeah.
Jose kneads his fist into his palm.
What can one do?
Try to help her. I tried, it didn't do much good. You got a ranch or something down in Brazil, don't you?
Yes.
That's good, she'll like that. Well, you better get in there.
Paul walks out. Jose glances at the bedroom door, then heads toward it. Opening it, he finds Holly curled on her bed. Feathers cover the floor. Several swirl and eddy at his feet. A few drift through the air, sailing down to her still form. As he lingers in the doorway, his long shadow stretches out to the foot of the bed. Daytime. Leafy branches flutter in a light wind outside the brownstone. A green and yellow cab pulls up and slows to a stop. Paul climbs out, fishes money out of his pocket, and pays the driver, nodding his thanks. He steps onto the sidewalk and fastens his suit jacket. Upstairs in Holly's newly decorated apartment, a record spins on a player.
Joga com a bola. O petis brinca com boneco.
On the wall hangs a poster of a brown-skinned fisherman and two planes zooming overhead. It reads, Jets to Brazil. A ball of red yarn spins in a glass bowl beside it. We follow the unwinding strand down to the floor, then up to Holly, who knits in a chair. She wears a pair of simple black pants and a beige sweater. Cat perches on the mounted head of a bull above her. Holly presses the buzzer and steps out onto the landing. Paul climbs up to meet her.
Hi.
Hello. I got your wire. How'd you know where to reach me?
Oh, I tried everything. Called people, asked around, and somebody thought of looking in the phone book. Anyway, I'm glad you could come.
They step inside.
You look fine.
You think so? Oh, I'm fat as a pig, and I haven't had my hair done in months. But I'm happy, really happy. Probably shows. You look très distingué yourself.
Got a job. I've been writing a little.
I know. I've read three of your stories. Two in the New Yorker and one in that funny little magazine.
They share a long look.
Won't you sit down?
Thank you.
I've taken up knitting.
So I see. Probably look very nice once it's finished.
Actually, I'm a little nervous about it. Jose brought up the blueprints for a new ranch house he's building. And I have this strange feeling that maybe the blueprints and my knitting instructions got switched. I mean, it isn't impossible that I'm knitting a ranch house.
She looks up from the large, misshapen sweater, gazes at him with a fading smile, then switches off the record player.
Really, darling, I can't tell you how divinely happy I am.
What is that, anyhow?
Portuguese, a very complicated language. 4,000 irregular verbs. Eu acho que você está gostando do açougueiro.
Very impressive. What's it mean?
I believe you are in league with the butcher.
She tosses a salad in the kitchen.
Holly, what's this about? Why did you want to see me?
Jose's in Washington for the night, so I thought if I asked you over, you might come. Well, I've said goodbye to everyone else I care about.
You're going somewhere?
I'm going to Rio tomorrow. I've got the plane ticket, and I've even said goodbye to old Sally.
Jose's flying down with you.
Well, we're going on separate planes, of course. He doesn't think it would look right for us to be traveling together. His family is very important down there, so he has to worry about things like that. Anyway, I thought I'd show off and cook dinner for us. It'll be fun eating in. Did I tell you how divinely and utterly happy I am?
Yes. You are getting married, then.
She uncorks a wine bottle.
Well, he hasn't really asked me, not in so many words.
Four, you mean?
Huh?
Well, that's how many words it takes. Will you marry me?
Oh, we'll get married, all right. I know we will. And in church, and with his family there, and everything. And that's why he's waiting till we get to Rio, probably.
A pot steams on the stove.
Do you think it's trying to tell us something?
I hope you like chicken and saffron rice served with chocolate sauce. It's an East Indian classic, my dear. 3 months ago, I couldn't scramble eggs.
The pressure cooker explodes, spewing rice everywhere. She leaps into his arms.
Oh, golly, darling, I did so want to impress you.
Look, I'm not much for chicken with sauce anyway. Why don't we go out somewhere? Let me buy you a farewell dinner.
Oh, that would be fun. As long as it's someplace I can go like this.
Later, they stroll down a Manhattan street, dwarfed by skyscrapers.
Years from now, years and years, I'll be back. Me and my 9 Brazilian brats. They'll be dark like Jose, of course, but they'll have bright green, beautiful eyes. I'll bring them back, all right, because they must see this. Oh, I love New York.
Then why are you leaving? What's in it for you anyway?
Look, I know what you're thinking, and I don't blame you. I've always thrown out such a jazzy line. But really, except for Doc and yourself, Jose's my first non-rat romance. Not that he's my idea of the absolute finito. He's too prim and cautious to be my absolute ideal. Now, if I could choose from anybody alive, I wouldn't pick Jose. Nero, maybe, or Albert Schweitzer. Or Leonard Bernstein. But I am mad about Jose. I honestly think I'd give up smoking if he asked me. Come on, darling, let's eat. It's getting late. I'm leaving tomorrow, and I haven't even begun to pack.
He flings his smoldering cigarette to the curb. As they cross the street to the entrance of a restaurant, she takes his arm. Later, in Holly's apartment, Kat watches them approach the brownstone from a window. Moments later, they enter the vestibule. Paul shuts the door. Holly digs through her purse.
Didn't want Jose to think I was the kind of girl who loses her key. So I have 26 of them made. No, wait, I got a better idea. Kind of a farewell gesture.
He leans against the door. It opens.
Somebody must have tripped the lock.
Ah, crafty devil, that Yuniyoshi. Wake up, the British are coming.
Or in this case, the Brazilians.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Ooh, I said I better clean up all that rice. Mm.
They enter her apartment.
Hey, you know, hey!
A man handcuffs him.
Ah, there she are, Lieutenant, the wanted woman. There.
Kronberger, narcotics squad.
What do you mean?
You all right now?
What's going on? Why don't you ask your boss?
What boss?
Sorry, tomato.
They smoke more than tomato. Look around. We're on narcotic. They got plenty narcotic in that.
Police shove them out into the hallway, leaving Yuniyoshi behind. Now, an unmarked car drives up to a police precinct. They all climb out. Waiting at the entrance, photographers take Paul and Holly's picture as detectives escort them into the building. Inside, Paul steps up to a desk.
What's your name?
Varjak.
Hold it down over there!
Paul Varjak, V-A-R-J.
A photographer snaps his picture.
Will you? Get out!
I'm a writer. W-R-I-T-E-R.
Behind him, reporters surround Holly, who's handcuffed to a policewoman. The women gesture for calm. The policewoman starts to blow.
Wait a minute! Get off!
Now, darling, why don't you start?
Is it true you carried messages from Tomato and Code?
Of course not. I just meet Mr. O'Shaughnessy at Hamburger Heaven and give him the weather report. Simply do not ask me what this is all about. Parce que je ne sais pas, mes chers.
But you did used to visit Tomato.
I used to see him every week. What's wrong with that?
Now, you must have known Tomato was part of the narcotic syndicate.
Mr. Tomato never mentioned narcotics to me. It makes me furious the way all these wretched people keep persecuting him. He's a deeply sensitive person. A darling old man.
Then you're innocent.
Of course I'm innocent.
What are you going to do about it?
What do you mean?
Well, who's your lawyer?
I don't know. Mr. O'Shaughnessy, I guess. Mr. O'Shaughnessy!
Two cops bring him in.
Get out of here!
All right, come on.
Okay, move.
Come on.
Mr. O'Shaughnessy?
Oh, shut up! Get in there.
She shrugs as the policemen throw him into an interrogation room. Now, Paul sits at a bar with several newspapers spread out in front of him. One headline reads, Tomato's Tomato, Pinched by Cops. Clutching a handful of coins, he steps into a phone booth, shuts the door, and picks up the receiver.
Yeah.
Mr. Paul Varjak?
Yeah.
Ready with Mr. Berman in Hollywood. Kindly deposit $3 for the first 3 minutes, please.
He drops coins into the slot. In a bedroom, O.J. reclines beside a speakerphone, elevating his bed to a seated position.
Hello? Hello?
O.J. Berman here. Who's calling?
Mr. Berman, this is Paul Varjak.
Nice to talk to you, kid.
Varjak. V-A-R-J-A-K. I'm a friend of Holly's. I met you at a party in New York.
Who?
Paul. Paul Varjak. V-A-R... Mr. Berman, this is Fred.
Oh, Fred Baby, huh?
Well, you call me about the kid, huh?
Everything's under control, eh? Just relax.
He stands.
I spoke to my lawyer in New York. I told him to take care of everything, send me the bill, but to keep my name anonymous.
What? Unknown. I don't want any part of it.
You hear me?
You sound like you're in a tunnel.
Oh. That's this executive phone I have.
What?
Executive phone. Right, baby, they only got her in 10,000 bail. My lawyer can get her out to 10 o'clock this morning. I'll tell you what you do. You bust into that dump she lives in, collect all the junk, get out of the jail, get her out, take her straight over to a hotel under a phony name, right? You want to keep away from the reporters as much as possible. You know what I mean? Will you do that?
Sure, Mr. Berman. I can't tell you how much I appreciate...
Forget it. I owe her something. Not that I owe her anything. I mean, if you really want to get right down to it. But...
He climbs back under the covers.
She's a crazy...
And lowers the bed.
She's a phony. But she's a real phony. You know what I mean, kid?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Thanks, Mr. Berman. Thanks a lot.
Right!
O.J. shuts off the light and snuggles into his pillow. The bed starts to rise again, on its own.
Why don't you bang?
He presses the controls. Morning. Beside a jail cell, Holly lights a cigarette, then walks out of the prison's back entrance into an alleyway. She puts on her sunglasses.
Kel Knight.
Paul waits for her at the curb, leaning on a yellow taxi. They embrace. He opens the door and they climb inside. As the cab takes off, raindrops begin to spatter onto the rear window.
I did a little housebreaking while you were away. Clayton Hotel driver, 84th and Madison.
She starts to change her clothes.
O.J. thinks it'd be a good idea if you stayed out of sight for a while. I got most of your stuff here, including Cat. Hope he's all right. Yeah.
Hello, Cat.
She kisses him.
Poor no-name slob.
Then pulls on a dress underneath her sweater.
Listen, darling, did you find that plane ticket?
Right here. We can cash it in.
Cash it in? Are you kidding? What time is it?
A little after 10.
Good. Idlewild Airport, please, driver.
Never mind. You can't do that.
Why not?
You don't understand. You're under indictment. If they catch you jumping bail, they'll lock you up and throw away the key.
Don't be ridiculous, darling. By the day after tomorrow, I'll be married to the future president of Brazil. And that'll give me diplomatic immunity or something.
You wouldn't bet on it.
What is it, darling?
She zips up the dress.
Message for you.
Oh. Oh, yes, I see. Did he bring it in person, or was it just there, shoved under the door?
A cousin.
Hand me my purse, will you, darling? A girl can't read that sort of thing without her lipstick. You read to me, will you, darling? I don't think I can quite bear.
Sure you want me to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My dearest little girl, I have loved you knowing you were not as others. But conceive of my despair upon discovering in such a brutal and public style how very different you are from the manner of woman a man of my position could hope to make his wife. I grieve for the disgrace of your present circumstances, and I do not find it in my heart to add my condemn to the condemn that surrounds you. So I hope you will find it in your heart not to condemn me. I have my family to protect and my name, and I am a coward where these institutions enter. Forget me, beautiful child, and may God be with you. Jose.
She puts on a trench coat.
Well?
Well, at least he's honest. It's kind of touching.
Touching? That square ball jazz.
He says he's a coward.
All right, so he's not a regular rat, or even a super rat. He's just a scared little mouse, that's all. But oh, golly! Gee, darn!
She buries her face in her hands and turns away from him.
Wow. So much for South America. I didn't really think you were cut out to be queen of the Pampas anyway. Clayton Hotel.
Idlewild.
What?
Plane leaves at 12, and on it I plan to be.
Holly, you can't.
Et pourquoi pas? I'm not hot-footing it after Jose, if that's what you think. Oh, no. As far as I'm concerned, he's the future president of nowhere. It's only why should I waste a perfectly good plane ticket? Besides, I've never been to Brazil.
He gapes at her.
Please, darling, don't sit there looking at me like that. I'm going, and that's all there's to it. Now, all they want from me are my services as a state's witness against Sally. Nobody has any intention of prosecuting me. To begin with, I don't have a ghost of a chance. Even so, this town's finished for me, at least for a while. There are certain shades of limelight that can wreck a girl's complexion. They'll have the rope up at every saloon in town. I'll tell you what you do for me, darling. When you get back to town, I want you to call up the New York Times or whoever you call. I want you to mail me a list of the 50 richest men in Brazil. The 50 richest!
Holly, I'm not going to let you do this.
You're not going to let me.
Holly, I'm in love with you.
So what?
So what? So plenty. I love you. You belong to me.
No. People don't belong to people.
Of course they do.
I'm not going to let anyone put me in a cage.
I don't want to put you in a cage. I want to love you.
The same thing.
No, it's not. Holly?
I'm not Holly. I'm not Nuno May either. I don't know who I am. I'm like Cat here. We're a couple of no-name slobs. We belong to nobody, and nobody belongs to us. We don't even belong to each other. Stop the cab.
It slows to a halt. Holly opens the door and stares out into the pounding rain.
What do you think? This ought to be the right kind of place for a tough guy like you. Garbage cans, rats galore. Scram! I said, take off! Beat it! Let's go.
They drive off, leaving Kat watching from behind a wrought iron gate pelted by rain. In the cab, Paul glares at Holly as she coolly lights a cigarette.
Driver.
He hands him a bill.
Pull over here.
The cab stops. Paul opens the door, steps out, raises the collar of his trench coat against the rain, and stares back at Holly.
You know what's wrong with you, Miss Whoever you are? You're chicken. You've got no guts. You're afraid to stick out your chin and say, okay, life's a fact. People do fall in love. People do belong to each other. Because that's the only chance anybody's got for real happiness. You call yourself a free spirit, a wild thing. And you're terrified somebody's going to stick you in a cage. Well, baby, you're already in that cage. You built it yourself. And it's not bounded in the west by Tulip, Texas, or in the east by Somaliland. It's wherever you go. Because no matter where you run, you just end up running into yourself.
Her eyes shine with welling tears. He reaches into his coat pocket and pulls out the ring box.
Here, I've been carrying this thing around for months.
He throws it into her lap.
I don't want it anymore.
Alone in the back seat, she winces and stares down at the velvet box. She opens it and takes out the inscribed Cracker Jack ring. Holly glances over her shoulder, briefly gazing out the rain-soaked window, then fiddles with the ring. Tears hang underneath her lashes. Her mouth falls open as she slips the ring onto the ring finger of her left hand. Shuddering, she gulps, glances over her shoulder again, then rushes out of the cab. She throws her cigarette away and tears down the sidewalk through the heavy downpour. Paul stands a few yards ahead of her next to the iron gate. Hands in his pockets, he peers down a nearby alleyway. Holly runs up behind him. He turns, a faint smile traces his lips. Rain streams down her face, mingling with her tears.
I don't know.
She glances around anxiously, then darts into the alley, stepping through puddles. Metal cans stuffed with garbage line one brick wall. Boxes and debris are shoved against others. She turns a corner and rushes past 5-foot-high wooden boxes. Holly frantically searches all around, pounding on the boxes. Glancing behind one, she pushes against it, then stands fretfully in the middle of the alley. Her shoulders slump. She wipes water off her face. Streaks of mascara run underneath her eyes. Her wet hair hangs limply on the back of her coat. Heading back, she sniffles deeply and takes a few last looks. She stops and stares blankly at Paul. He sorrowfully returns her gaze. Kat peeks out of one of the boxes. Holly bends down, picks him up, and presses him to her face. The tin ring gleams on her hand as she strokes his matted fur. Paul watches as Holly kisses Kat, holds him against her chest, and wraps the lapels of her coat around him. She rises and walks back to Paul, gulping in relief. As they stand face to face, she stares with wide, hopeful eyes. He pulls her into an embrace. They kiss tenderly, clasping Kat between them as rain cascades into the alley. Our view pulls back, farther and farther still from the kissing couple in the driving rain. To black. A title reads, The End, a Paramount Picture. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH, Boston. Described by Lisa Benjamin. Descriptions read by Rena Baskin. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. For a complete listing of DVS programs and services, call toll-free 1-800-333-1203. Additional credits. Art direction by Hal Pereira and Roland Anderson. Edited by Howard Smith, ACE. Special photographic effects by John P. Fulton, ASC. Process photography by Farcio Edwart, ASC. Set decoration by Sam Comer and Ray Moyer. Assistant director, William McGarry. Costume supervision by Edith Head. Miss Hepburn's wardrobe principally by Hubert de Givenchy. Miss Neal's wardrobe principally by Pauline Trigere. Makeup supervision by Wally Westmore, SMA. Hairstyle supervision by Nellie Manley, CMS. Sound recording by Hugo Grenzbach and John Wilkinson. Technicolor color consultant Richard Mueller. Two logos, the IATSE insignia and the seal of approval from the MPAA, certificate number 19835. Copyright 1961 by Paramount Pictures Corporation and Juro Shepherd Productions, Incorporated. Song Moon River by Johnny Mercer and Henry Mancini. Color by Technicolor.